I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. One of the signs of COVID is the loss of the sense of smell called anosmia. It affects about half of the people who contract the virus. Most who recover from COVID regain their ability to smell, but not everyone. For them, their sense of smell disappears or gets distorted, and not in a good way. Things that used to smell good can smell like rotting garbage or sweaty socks or raw sewage. That's called parosmia. Today, we're going to explore our sense of smell and our nose's ability to sniff its way through the world. And we begin with Danielle Reed. She's Associate Director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center, which is here in Philadelphia. She'll help us understand the connection between COVID and smell and why losing that sense is such a threat to our mental and physical health. Danielle Reed, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes, it's lovely to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Do we know what the virus does to our sense of smell?
What we think happens is that the virus actively infects the cells in the nose that nourish the smell cells in the nose. And so when these nourishing cells get infected with the virus, they secrete an alarm signal, which essentially shuts down the entire sense of smell.
And when you shut down the entire sense of smell, you also affect the ability to taste things, true?
Well, we think that they're the same process, but in just in different cell types. So taste is really on the tongue. It's the sour, sweet, salty, bitter that you learned in high school. And what happens in the nose is a different set of cells. But our perception is taste and smell go together so beautifully in the brain because our brain integrates that information to give us flavor.
You were telling me before going on the air that the variants have had a different effect on our ability to smell. Help us understand that.
Yeah, so absolutely. So in the early days of the pandemic, so we're talking alpha, pre-alpha, beta, gamma. So the sense of smell was lost in about, you know, anywhere between 50 and even 80% of people,
wow,
depending on how carefully we can measure that loss of smell. But we see with Delta, people lost their sense of smell a bit less. And now with Omicron, it looks somewhere between 5 and 15% are losing their sense of smell. And we think this is just because the variants cause different amounts of this alarm signal.
So what happens, I'm assuming, let's take someone who does recover. So their sense of smell returns. Is it the same sense of smell they had before COVID?
Here's the challenging part. How will we know? Because our sense of smell is never or rarely measured in the doctor's office. So you might know your 20/20 vision, but you don't know your nose was 20/20 before the pandemic. So people just kind of have to go by how they think their smell is recovered. And there's always a lot of rumination about, well, it's about how it used to smell, but it's hard to tell for sure.
Is there any way that we could do a kind of 20/20 vision test for smell?
This is a big goal that we have. This has really mobilized all of the smell scientists in the world to develop a quick, maybe fun test that we could do in our doctor's office so that we would get that in our medical records. You know, it's not only COVID, because hopefully COVID will at one day wane and be over, but loss of smell is actually a hallmark symptom of a lot of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So I think it's super critical to have this information. It'd also be wonderful to test children. So a lot of people are born without a sense of smell, and it'd be nice to really understand that earlier rather than later.
I mean, would it be possible to come up with some kind of a universal smell that for everyone essentially smells the same?
Right. So that's a challenge.
How would you do that, right?
Right. Because, you know, we all think of cinnamon and vanilla, but that's very culture specific. So the most go-to universal odor that all of the scientists like is something called phenyl ethyl alcohol, which is a fancy way of saying like a rose or a floral odor. So flowers is the one thing we think may be universal.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, let's go back to COVID, and let's go back to those people who do not recover that sense of smell that they thought they had before COVID. You're talking about, about 15% of people, something like that?
Anywhere between 10 and 15% of people. Now, we can't say never, right? So we don't know never. We only know that they haven't recovered over the last 2 years. Obviously, we're hoping that people may eventually recover. But for now, it seems like not only are people not recovering, but they're actually getting worse with the parosmia and something called phantosmia, which is when you smell things that aren't even there.
Is this long COVID? I mean, would this be one of the signs of long COVID, that you did not get your sense of smell back?
Correct. So part of the constellation, long COVID means many different things to many people, but one hallmark symptom of long COVID is that they have a sustained loss of smell or loss of the normal sense of smell.
Why, when someone's sense of smell begins to recover or is distorted in some kind of way, why does it distort so that it smells badly? Why doesn't everything smell like a rose when you went on the road to recovery?
It'd be a better world for all of the people
sure
who
would.
Are suffering if things did smell good. But the sense of smell at the most basic level is an alarm sense, right? It keeps you away from sewage. It keeps you away from the things that are bad. And so when the sense of smell is sort of struggling to get back online, we think it goes negative as a way to try to protect, right? It's a sentinel sense, and it's not doing the job correctly, but it's trying hard to keep us safe.
And obviously, as you said, our sense of smell wants us to keep us away from rotten food or rotting corpses. And I'm thinking of all the really dangerous and smelly smells of the world.
Yes, absolutely. But you can imagine what it's like for people who get up and that morning cup of coffee is really fecal, or their pets start smelling like cadavers. It's really, really devastating for people. And they don't get a lot of sympathy from either friends, family, and the medical community.
What, because they don't believe it? They don't understand it? They don't have this kind of respect for what our nose is supposed to do?
We've all experienced pain, right? So we can understand if somebody has a headache or they feel unwell in ways that we understand. But it's really hard to connect for most people of what it's like to smell your coffee and have it smell fecal. I mean, we don't have that experience. And so we try to be empathetic and sympathetic, but many people just don't have the lived experience. And certainly the medical community, there's a little bit of puzzlement. Like, we've had people write to us and say, my physician says this is unusual, or they've never heard of it before. And so there's this sort of lack of knowledge. So that's another thing that's really disturbing to people. People just don't understand, know about, or validate what they're going through.
I mean, that can lead to things like depression or loneliness.
Both of those things. So one of the things that's been most striking about people that have had this loss or distorted sense of smell are the high rates of depression. And we don't know if people that were previously depressed are more vulnerable to these changes, or whether these changes are driving people into these senses of isolation and despair.
How do you deal with that?
So there are two ways. One is to connect. So there are a lot of really thriving support groups online, mostly support groups for people that are going through these changes. And that, for many people, is so beneficial to share their experience and to really talk to other people who know what they're experiencing, because they themselves are experiencing it. And the other thing that can help people is the idea that there are scientists like me and scientists throughout the world where we haven't figured it out yet, but we're really working hard to try to figure out if there's a way to tone this alarm signal down, to somehow cause these cells to repair correctly. So people are really working hard on it.
Well, and I'm wondering too, is there a way to sort of retrain our ability to smell? Let's say our coffee smells like sewage. Is there a way to train our nose in a sense so that we can get that coffee or something that approximates that smell of coffee?
Right. So there is sort of physical therapy for the nose, and that's called smell training. And it's really a combination of routine. It's sort of like exercise. You got to do it every day. And mindfulness. So you pick some odorants and you smell them very deliberately and intentionally. And you smell it, it's lemon. You smell it, it's lemon. It's a way to try to train the brain back. Now, this is partially effective and only in some people. And it's surprisingly hard to do, because it's just like exercise. We want to see those benefits right away, right? Everybody's like that, really. We want to see that. And smell training, you have to stay with it to realize right. Those benefits.
And you're smelling a lemon and you're saying, this smells like a lemon. I mean, it's that sort of obvious what you're trying to do.
Right. So it's very important, the intentionality. It's not just smelling the odorant, but connecting your brain with what the odorant is. And so a lot of times people use essential oils that have particular known odor qualities, the rose, the orange, the vanilla, to try to re-engage all parts of the brain to regrow appropriately.
And are women, men affected differently by COVID and this loss of sense of smell?
Absolutely. So the gender differences are quite striking. Middle-aged women are the people who seem to be most susceptible to the sustained smell loss. Certainly, I wouldn't want to say men. Plenty of men have this problem too, for sure. But on average, it's more likely to be women, and women between the ages of 40 to maybe 50, 55, 60, along in there. Those are the peak people that are really suffering the most.
So I have to ask, what's some of the speculation on that? Why?
Well, we don't know for sure, but it might be that this alarm signal is particularly effective in women as they approach menopause. It may be that the body is not repairing for some reason as well. We really don't know why. We just know at this point the description of what actually happens.
I'm curious about what happens to our ability to smell as we age. Do we lose some of the sort of finer details of smell as we get older?
Well, we're all envious of our friends and family members who, as they age, have perfect eyesight or perfect hearing.
Yes.
And there are people who manage to make it into old age with a perfect sense of smell. But these folks are, frankly, quite rare. And so we all lose our sense of smell and taste as we age gradually, and we often don't necessarily notice the loss until we're sort of in a moment where we're, we may be walking in and like, it's not quite as... Not as cinnamon-y as I remember, or the turkey doesn't smell quite like I remembered. But again, it harkens back to, it would be wonderful to really have a concrete sense of this, but we don't, because we don't measure our sense of smell.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye. So what is Monell? What's the research that you're working, or Monell is working on, looking at COVID and smell?
We're really trying to understand at the molecular level what actually happens when people lose their sense of smell, with the idea that if we understand what's going on fully and completely, then the therapies will come.
And what got you interested in smell?
Oh, that's very interesting. I'm very interested in how people are different, and people's sense of smell one from another is very different. And that just fascinates me. Why is this the case?
And is that what makes it hard to study in a way? Because everything is so unique when it comes to smell.
Absolutely. And trying to find the universals from the particular, individual differences is one of the challenges.
Well, Danielle Reed, thank you for getting our conversation started. And thanks for joining us today in Radio Times. She is Associate Director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center, which is here in Philadelphia. And we were talking about what we know so far about this connection between COVID and smell. We've got a second guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking more about our sense of smell, and we always want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about what it's like to contract COVID and lose your sense of smell, or have your sense of smell so distorted that what used to smell sweet and good smells simply awful. Our ability to smell is critical to our survival, our ability to enjoy food and drink, and the social and psychological benefits that come with having all our senses intact. But smell does not get the same respect and attention that our other senses get, and our guest wants to change that. Jude Stewart has written a new book titled Revelations in Air, A Guidebook to Smell. She describes how complex the nose is, why smells are so connected to our memories, how to develop a better sense of smell, and much, much more. She's a journalist and author who writes about design and culture for Slate, The Believer, Fast Company, and other publications, and joins us on Radio Times. Jude Stewart, nice to have you with us on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, let's begin where your book begins. You went to an art exhibit in Germany, Smeller 2.0, and that began your quest to better understand this sense of smell. What was this exhibit all about?
Well, so I would start by saying it was like you walk into a hermetically sealed room, and I went inside, and one wall of the room was all white. It was almost looked like a church organ, you know, many different kind of pipes coming in. And this this contraption had the ability to sort of pump in a smell very quickly and then also remove it quickly. So you'd smell the smell of Band-Aids for, you know, 10 seconds or less, and then it'd be removed and suddenly it would be, you know, citrus or something else. And it was like being plugged into an electric socket, you know.
Oh, wow.
It was, and all the ways, right. It was a little like upsetting. It was exhilarating. It was upsetting. It was exciting. And I kind of couldn't believe how intense it was. And, you know, I came back out and started looking into, I think I initially wanted to look into smell-o-vision. And there's a long history of this idea of putting smells in with, you know,
movies,
syncing them to movies and
yeah.
so forth. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I just really fell down the rabbit hole.
Well, it's funny because you said you smelled Band-Aids, and I know exactly what that smell smells like, but I don't know what the words are. Is that part of the problem of trying to write about
yeah.
smells, which is finding the right vocabulary?
There's a term for that that's called the tip of the nose phenomena. So, and that was part of what was crazy making in a way of being in this exhibit was you'd smell it, you'd recognize it, but you were too slow to come up with what it was. And so, you know, it was sort of having that button pushed over and over. And yeah, that's very common.
Well, help us understand then how the brain processes smell.
Okay. Well, so at the very basic level, it's the process of smelling is called olfaction, the biological process. And what happens is little tiny particles of the thing you're smelling sort of waft their way up your nose. They make their way to the area in your nose where like glasses would rest, that bridge. There's an area there where olfactory receptors are waiting to bind with these smells. And then they shoot a signal into a little area of your brain called the olfactory bulb. And that's where you do the recognition and processing of smells. So what's interesting about that is it's completely bypassing all these like higher order areas of your brain, like that are involved in verbal functioning. And that's why it's like it's hard to connect up words. These things are not connected in the brain.
But we do connect memories. And as you write, it connects to the amygdala, the hippocampus. And in many ways, that's where yep. memories reside. So, I'm sure all of our listeners can think of a smell that would take them back to their childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. The amygdala is the area that processes your emotions. And then the hippocampus is where you have a lot of your memories stored. And so these areas are very closely tangled up with smells in the brain. And so those things fuse together pretty readily. And as we all know, you know, it's just incredible how forcefully and clearly a smell can evoke a particular memory.
Well, I'm thinking music can do that as well, right? You hear a song from your, you know, teenage years and there you are at the dance, right? same idea, I guess.
Absolutely.
It's funny, we've done shows about dogs' noses, which are extraordinary. They have this, you know, amazing ability to sniff out the world. But human noses are no slouch. Help us give some respect to the human nose, if you could.
Well, I'm also a fan of the dog nose. I love it. If your listeners are interested, there's a book called Being a Dog by Alexandra Horowitz.
Yeah, she's been on. Yeah, it's
entirely
terrific.
So great. But, okay, props for the humans, though. We are good at smelling. We are very good at distinguishing between smells. We don't have quite the ability to catch a very faint whiff of something. Dogs are quite good at that, catching smells at very low concentrations. What we're good at is knowing the difference between the fake strawberry flavor and an actual strawberry and maybe an overripe strawberry. Like, we can distinguish really fine gradations. And that kind of also has to do with our brains, and our brains are just really overwired for smell and an awareness of those distinctions. So it's an interesting kind of evolutionary question why that would be so, but that's our superpower with smell.
And is it different for men and women, do you think? I mean, anecdotally, I feel like women have a better sense of smell than men, but that's just based on, not based on science at all. Does the science tell us anything?
You know, I wish we had the scientists on, we could ask. But yeah, I wondered when I was listening earlier to her speak. I think anecdotally, I also have observed that women are better, and it's interesting to hear that women are having the problems with their loss of smell, and they might be more susceptible, but they also might be just a little bit more tuned in to their awareness of their sense of smell, so that when there's a loss, they can perceive it and they can articulate it and speak to it. So it might be, kind of an interesting, it's not that necessarily that they're more prone, it's just they notice.
Is there a smell that all humans like, or, you know, that smells good to all us humans?
There were a flurry of studies recently that came out about this, which I thought was fun. It was a cross-cultural study to ask that very question, and the answer they came back with was vanilla. Huh? Vanilla. So vanilla is an interesting smell, and one of the things about it that it's ubiquitous, as you probably have noticed. It's like in all kinds of baked goods, anything that, you know, you bake, pretty much put a little vanilla in. And it has this great quality of like enhancing whatever the star of the show flavor is. So you don't usually notice the vanilla, but you'll notice that star a little more. And it also doesn't do the thing that often will make us dislike a smell. There's a series of nerves in our face called the trigeminal nerve, mm-hmm. and it's sort of like a feeling of touch. It's like activated when you chop onions or when you smell something like eucalyptus or, you know, chilies. And we don't always like that reaction when it occurs, and it can be activated through smells. And vanilla is unusual in that it doesn't activate that nerve at all. Mm. So it's the main reason to dislike a smell is absolutely absent with vanilla.
But it's so funny that we use the word vanilla now to describe something that's kind of bland and boring, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that happen?
Vanilla deserves my respect. Yeah. Oh, well, you have to get the chapter in the book and find out, because there is actually a whole tale around that.
Do you have a favorite smell?
Oh, boy. I really like the smell of pipe tobacco. Huh? So it's interesting with this book, you know, I sat down for several days in a row and I would just smell one thing all the time and then do all the research around that thing, and you do eventually kind of hit the wall with like every smell. But pipe tobacco was the one smell that I never got tired of taking in. So before it's burnt, I just there's a beautiful variety to it, and it has this kind of these associations for me of home. My family's from Kentucky and North Carolina, and and it feels like rooms full of books. It has a lot of good associations. I like that one a lot.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned rooms full of books, because for me, you know, that's a very evocative smell. I think because I grew up in old, musty old houses. And so when that smelled like old books, and in many ways, because there were old books in those houses. But what am I smelling? When we smell old books, what is that? What makes it so evocative, do you think?
Well, the paper that has changed, paper has changed over time that's used in books. So books that are before a certain vintage, I think it was around 1970 when we started having acid-free paper. Books that are before that and even older are made with different materials. And so those materials are degrading. And so what you're smelling is this process, slow process of decomposition. I also love that smell, too. Yeah. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah. I mean, it's sweet and musky at the same time, right?
Yeah, there's a sense of distance inside of it too. You know, you feel like you're cracking open some other world. It really works with the actual idea of opening a book and getting lost in it.
Well, we're talking about smell on the radio with our guest, Jude Stewart, and she's written a book about smell, and it's called Revelations in Air, a Guidebook to Smell. And she's a journalist, author, writes about design and culture for a number of publications, and obviously joining us on Radio Times to help us understand this sense that doesn't get the kind of respect that our other senses get. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. What's your favorite smell? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jude, I don't know how hard it would or how easy it would be to research this, but I'm assuming that there are smells that have gone extinct, you know, in the last 2,000, 3,000 years, just because, you know, life is so different today compared to back then. Do we know the answer to that question?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. Sure. I have a chapter in the book about extinct flowers, the smell of extinct flowers, because that sort of was a curiosity of a group of artists who worked with some biotechnicians to see if they could revive the smells of extinct flowers. And the idea, I think, there was to sort of evoke in an emotional way, you know, the cost of climate change. So when you lose the smell of a particular flower because it doesn't exist anymore, it's usually because you've lost a whole ecosystem that no longer really works that way. So there was an art exhibition that went around that, you know, showed the results of their work. So, yeah. And then there's an interesting corollary to that, the idea of, like, smells going extinct. There are also new smells being created all the time in labs. And I find this crazy that your brain or your nose can encounter something that never existed in nature and smell it and observe it. I have a perfume that is made 100% of it, like a completely lab invented molecule. And wow, it just blows my mind. I think it's so interesting.
So what does it smell like?
You know, it kind of smells like a lily. It's like a slightly rotting lily. It's got a sort of a sweet edge to it, but it also has this warmth, and it's called Molecule Number One, and it's a nice smell.
Here's a question from Tim, and this is actually something that you wrote about in the book that I underscored. Tim says, right after it rains, there's a very pleasant, fresh smell that seems to come out of the ground. It only lasts for a little while. Do we know what it is? What is it, Jude?
Oh, thank you for teeing me up, because
yeah,
I love that smell.
Perfect,
it's called,
right?
Petrichor. Yeah, petrichor. And what it is the it's the smell of the plants secrete this kind of this material into the soil. And when there's a, you know, long period between rains, and the idea is they're actually kind of trying to, like, it's a sort of competitive source. It's, you know, they're competing for the limited water. So when it finally rains, the soil is aerated, and then the substance is kind of released into the air, and it's just briefly freshly available, and then it just dissipates. And I love that there is a word for this. And,
yeah, petrichor.
You know, I think we all enjoy that smell.
Yeah.
Petrichor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that a Latin word or made up word, or where did that come from? Do we know?
Yes. It means, I think it means blood of stones. I think it's a Greek word. Yeah. I have a chapter on it in the book.
You also, speaking of weather, say that our nose can predict snow. How does that work?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a funny one, because it's a sort of roundabout thing where, but when you're smelling snow, there are sort of three things happening. The first thing is what you're smelling in a cold environment is actually kind of dampened, or it's, you know, your sense of smell is not working as well as it would in a warm, humid environment. So the first thing you're smelling is kind of the blankness that comes with really cold weather. Mm. And then the second thing is a sudden bump in humidity. So that awareness that precipitation is coming comes to your nose, and suddenly it sort of turns the smells back on. So that is something we can kind of observe. And then the third thing, going back again to these trigeminal nerves in your face, those are kind of activated a little bit when the sense of snow is coming. And so you feel that kind of tingling in your face. And those three signals together are a pretty reliable indicator it's going to snow.
Can humans smell other humans' emotions, things like fear or joy, anger, jealousy? Is that a scent that we give off?
Indeed, it is. It is. Yes, there are several studies that have identified at least a couple emotions. You mentioned joy and fear. Disgust is another one. There may be others. There was one experiment I sort of enjoyed where two sets of people went in with very clean T-shirts on and no lotions or anything. They went into movie theaters, and they each group watched a different movie. One group watched The Shining, Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, gosh.
So that's the fear group.
About fear, right, okay.
Right. And then the other group went and watched the Jungle Book, Disney's The Jungle Book. So that's the happy group. So they came out, you know, with their sweat-stained T-shirts, and then those T-shirts were given to a different group of people to, you know, kind of decide which one was the fear T-shirt, which one was the happy T-shirt, and it was really sort of very easy to determine the difference. So yes, we're emanating these emotions into a T-shirt, it's observable by someone else who even doesn't know us.
So people are able to very accurately predict which movie they had seen based on the smell of their T-shirt.
Correct.
So that gets us to our skin. Help us understand then, in terms of us emanating smells, how does our skin work?
Well, what's I love this. I did a section on, yeah, a chapter on skim, and I love this because your body is giving off so much information into the air all the time through the sense of smell, and you know, we're generally not consciously paying attention. So there's a level of kind of a baseline level of your sense of smell, or sorry, your body, mm-hmm. where you know, below everything else that you might wear, like perfumes or what have you, and you're giving the smell off all the time, and that is actually giving information about your immune system. It is keyed off of a gene called the MHC gene, and yeah, it indicates sort of the robustness of your immune system, but also sort of what kind of variety of gene you have. And so it plays a role in at least in heterosexual interactions where, you know, we will tend to be attracted to someone who, among other things, smells like they have a different and a differently robust version of this gene, so that we will want to be with that kind of person. So it does play some role there. And I thought that was really interesting. But there are several diseases that give off a smell signature. COVID is one of them, but also MS, different types of cancer. So, you know, so that it can play a role in diagnostics. You know, what you're eating in terms of the types of foods and cuisines that you take in will eventually subtly work with your sense of smell. So if you've ever had a really hot curry or you had a big garlic thing the night before, it's not just your mouth, it's a little stinky, it's your whole body a little bit is giving off a smell. So we're constantly fluctuating and sending out this different information through our largest body or organ, which is our skin.
I'm trying to think of words here on the radio, but is that a kind of fingerprint for us then, that we all have our own distinctive smell?
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. Right, so not only I might be MHC gene number one and maybe you're number three, but it goes beyond that. So we have actually a fairly unique signature that way. So we're not just in types and groups, but I believe that it is unique to us. And only if you have an identical twin would someone have the exact same signature as you.
The same kind of smell signature.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else, it's all something different. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guests. We're talking with Jude Stewart and she's got a new book. It's called Revelations in Air. It's a guidebook to smell. And we began the show talking about COVID and its impact on our ability to smell. But there's a lot about our nose and about our senses of smell that's really fascinating. And there's some fascinating new research as well. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guest Jude Stewart about how to have a better sense of smell and to better understand our sense of smell, how distinct odors can unlock memories, how a well-functioning sense of smell is good for our health, how there are some universal smells that we all love and we all hate. And again, you can always join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do we smell ourselves accurately the way other people smell us?
In what sense?
Well, that, I mean, picking up on what you were saying about how we each have our sort of unique fingerprint smell, something that's unique about us, is our understanding of our own smell as accurate as the people around us who smell us? Does that make any sense?
I think habituation would be working against us here, you know,
right.
And you get used to your own sense of smell. So it would be hard for you to diagnose yourself. You know, if you had cancer or something like that, I think you wouldn't probably discern those differences. But it is interesting to think about this idea that we have a sense of smell and we do deeply recognize it. So a couple like scattered kind of examples come to mind when I mentioned the cancer. I've heard several anecdotes about
people's dogs, you know, nudging on a particular mole on their leg and would not be let go from like licking and touching that mole. And then later on, they would find out that mole is cancerous. So the dog is observing a difference in that mole from what you usually smell like. So that's one example. Another one that I kind of like that involves in recognizing your own sense of smell is if you've ever kind of had a gross smell caught in your nose and you want to get it out, a fun trick is that you can just put your arm up and smell inside your own elbow, and it will kind of reset and clear your nose. And so that's a way you can use your own sense of smell to kind of bring yourself back to baseline.
I love that. Here's an email from Al. He says, I'm an artist and art professor at Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. One of my favorite smells is the sweet smell of oil paint when I walk into my studio or classroom. And I mean, that's a lovely image and a lovely smell. Anything you want to add to that, Jude?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love that idea of like, you know, a smell that kind of primes you to get ready and be in a different headspace, you know, the space to make art. That's fantastic. I love that.
Let me ask you about baby smells. If you've had, maybe that is the best smell in the world. I don't know. Even as I said it, I could smell a baby I had, you know, 40 years ago. But help us understand, I guess, the mother-baby smell connection.
Oh, yeah. That one has been very well studied, and it's kind of shocking the degree to which, you know, people can recognize their own baby. And I have an almost 9-year-old son, so I can bring that smell right back to mind as well. Yeah. It's probably linked to breastfeeding, but if you think about it, it starts even earlier. I mean, babies are actually smelling inside the womb, and what they're doing is essentially practicing. They're taking in the flavors that mothers are consuming, but also things like, you know, shampoos and lotions and things, and it all comes through the amniotic fluid, and they're just kind of tasting and practicing. So we're preparing a child's palate, while they're in the womb, and they're also sensing and smelling us all the time. So it's, I mean, probably what the most extreme study that I'm thinking of. There's some women who were had very limited exposure to their newborn, and then there was a, you know, kind of a test of, do you recognize the onesie that your baby has worn? In some cases, these women had like 10 minutes of exposure to their child, and then they were whisked away and asked to smell the onesie. And they're highly, highly attuned to doing it. And what's more, it wasn't just the woman. The fathers also were quite good at smelling the child and understanding the smell of the child right away, which is a little mind-boggling.
But it does tell us about the importance of smell and survival, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Going back to like why we smell in the first place, you know, it is it's a sense that helps us detect oncoming threats. You know, things like there's a forest fire, I better not go over there. This food is a little off, I don't want to eat it. So I think it's easy to talk up smell as the sentinel sense of danger, but there's also this really beautiful flip side, which is like the opportunity and what's beautiful and what attracts us. And, you know, mom smells great, you know, your partner smells great. Food that is delicious is, you know, draws us in like a magnet. So smell is helping us understand those things too.
Well, and you mentioned disgust, and even the word disgust, you sort of, you know, grimace your face. I mean, there is something about something that smells disgusting that we have such a visceral response to. And you write about the fact that smells have been used to discriminate against other people, that there's a dark side to this as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, it's you know, operating at the level of unconscious bias. So, you know, I think it's important to kind of point this out, that people who don't smell like you in general do not smell well, in your opinion. You know, that smell is never considered good. So there definitely is some evidence, you know, historically of prejudicial use of smell against people. I think it's important for us to kind of be mindful of that. One of the smells that I enjoyed spending time with was the smell durian, which is do you know that one?
Okay. No, I only know it because you wrote about it.
Right. So it's a super smelly fruit from Malaysia and Southeast Asia, and it's very often made into ice cream. And so it's got this really weird profile in that it smells like kind of like rotting onions. On the outside, and then when you open up the fruit, it's got this beautiful creamy interior, and it makes this delicious kind of custardy, high sugar ice cream. And so I wanted to kind of get to know a stink that I wasn't familiar with, that a lot of people love, and that actually has kind of a you know, sometimes when people say they don't like durian, it's got a little racist vibe to it. So I thought, let me make friends with the stink. And so we made a bunch of durian ice cream, and I just ate it and enjoyed it and kind of enjoyed the weirdness of it, you know?
Well, and you described durian, rotten eggs, roasting onions, soup broth, sweet lychee, hot garbage in summer, a boiling pot of ammonia, ripe mango, well-spiced cabbage. So it was somehow all those taste, which I think most people would not enjoy, but somehow when it all came together and became ice cream, it was tasty.
Yeah, it actually was. It's just that you're just not used to smelling a fruit that has that kind of robust signature that's mostly a savory signature. And then the combination with this very sweet, cold, you know, ice cream. It was pretty akin to actually eating stinky cheese when you smell really stinky cheese and then you get it in your mouth and there's that kind of, oh, it smells like feet, but it, you know, it's melting on my tongue in this incredible, you know, liquid manner. If you picture that, it's like a really similar pleasure.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about stinky cheese, and it seems that, I don't know if that's an acquired taste, but just over time, I guess maybe through experience, you realize it smells one way, but it tasted another.
Yeah, and that's part of the fun, right? It's just, whoa, how can this smell so bad and yet taste so good?
Well, let me see what Martin has to say. Martin joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Martin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just recalled when I was a child, I could smell when someone had an illness in the family. And I don't know if it's something other people might have had. I think I had a much more sensitive sense of smell when I was young. In fact, I've lost most of my sense of smell. But I definitely could smell when someone was ill. And I remember a morning where I woke up and I smelled the odor. It was illness, either a cold or a flu or something. And I came downstairs. It was a large house. And my grandmother was sitting there, and they had a thermometer in her mouth, and she was ill.
Wow. And so, you knew that as a kid. Martin, you lost your sense of smell, or just it has sort of left you over time?
I don't know. The past few years, I've lost most of my sense of smell, and it had nothing to do with COVID. I don't know why, and it has me concerned, but I've lost most of it.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, but I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jude, anything you want to add to that?
Wow, well, that's an amazing superpower. I'm pretty impressed by that. When people have a sudden loss of smell, it is worth investigating. I mean, sometimes when people have a really bad bout of like a respiratory illness, you know, whether it's COVID or not, you know, that can be a lingering after effect, and smell training can help. If you've had a blow to your face, like a, you know, if you've had a hit right in that area, then you can. The chances there that, you know, those olfactory nerves are severed, and then that might not be reparable. So I would go to a doctor and just check it out.
Yeah, yeah. And also based on what our first guest was talking about as well, just the importance of making sure that our senses are as healthy as they can be. Martin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jude, I have to say one of the smells that I'm smelling a lot more, and maybe just because there's so many looser marijuana laws, but the smell of pot, it's kind of everywhere now, I have to say. I don't know if you've noticed that or not.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I live in Chicago, and it was also legalized right around the time when I was starting to write the chapter, and it was suddenly everywhere. But it's a pretty interesting smell, and there's wild variety to it. And what was perhaps the most surprising thing to me was I was taking this curiosity of, like, let me examine a smell really closely, and taking it to all these objects, and cannabis is actually one of those things that has a great range of smells. Like, different strains will have different smells, and if you're really quite good and you know your cannabis well, then you can just discern between them just based on smells alone. So I was surprised at the range.
And the idea of, and you write about this, the kind of intimacy of smell, that things have to be up close in order to smell them versus, you know, something that's way off in the distance that you might be looking at, that there is a kind of intimacy of this connection.
This is true. Well, it is a little gross to think, oh, the thing that I'm smelling, you know, that might be really stinky is actually going up your nose. But I'm sorry to say that is true. But then at the same time, that's it gets back to an important aspect of smell, which is, you know, it's really bodily. And we can't send smells on the internet, which is part of its charm, as far as I'm concerned. And when you're smelling something, you're really like emphasizing the fact that your body is in a particular place right here and now, and that smell will not be there forever. And so there's a sort of nice present. It really makes you feel more present in a space.
Richard emailed saying, what's the relationship between incredibly awful smells and nausea, even vomiting?
Well, I mean, again, going back to this idea of, why do we smell in the first place is, is that it's a warning. I mean, you know, if you smell something that's bad enough, and maybe you've previously been sick eating it, you know, your body's going to do everything it can to sort of expel that. And so senses are always acting together. That's another thing that I think is important to talk about, is that smells are concatenating reality for us, or senses are concatenating reality for us. So if you're smelling something and the visual doesn't look that good, and you have the memory activated, and you know, your maybe your stomach is gurgling a little, all of these senses are together going to say, get that thing out of me.
I was curious about new car smell. And as you write, I mean, I think, again, we know what that smells like. But you're saying in China, that's not an attractive smell for people that are interested in buying a car.
Right. I know. It's an interesting cultural difference. And I mean, for the record, you know, Chinese consumers are onto something, because that smell is basically off-gassing plastic. It's not great for you. And there are people who have, you know, enough sensitivity to it that it's, you know, considered an allergen, and, you know, it has some not great health benefits. But it's really a consumer preference, too. And so it's interesting to look into different patents that are being put together to, you know, absolutely remove all the smells from a car and deliver a completely, you know, smelly blank car to the consumer.
KW wants to know, do we smell in our dreams? Do we know, Jude?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think it's pretty rare. I mean, if this person has has that a capability, I would love to hear more. Yeah, it's hard to access smells. It doesn't work the way all of our other senses are. It's not easy to conjure up a smell in your mind, for example, and imagine the smell. Whereas if you encounter the smell of your grade school or something, then you're going to picture it right away, and all these other, you know, senses are going to deliver the grade school to you. So it doesn't, we don't have quite the same, you know, access to it, easy access that we might with other senses. But that's part of, like, I think why it's so emotionally powerful.
You write about Plato as an invented smell. And again, I say the word Plato, I have a feeling, and that's Plato, not Plato, a Plato. I'm almost sure that everyone knows exactly what that smells like. What are we smelling?
Well, there's a patent applied to that. There's a trademark, you know, that you can look up and find out exactly what it's described. But yes, it's the smell of, you know, a kind of a dough, the salted dough that has a slight kind of rose or flowery scent attached to it. But it's, of course, got a little bit of wetness to it as well, which helps the smell deliver to our nose. Now, I was interested in that one because there aren't that many trademark smells, and Plato happens to be probably the most well-known of all of them. And so I wanted to kind of understand what that works, how that works, because trademarks are not the same quite as patents. They are protecting, rather than the actual function of what the thing will do, they're protecting the sort of the intangible qualities of the product. So when you're smelling a trademark smell like Play-Doh, what you're getting from that smell is, this is recognizably, verifiably Play-Doh and not some imitation.
We're almost out of time here, but you also describe exercises and things people can do to have a better developed sense of smell. Give us one.
I kept a little smell journal on my my phone when I was starting this project, and the idea was just to start noticing smells more, and my goal was to try and notice one smell a day and then just write down what I observed. And that had two levels of benefit, and one of them was expected and the other one was unexpected. The expected one was that I did start noticing more smells. If you're looking for one every day, you will end up with usually more than one. So I did tune into my sense. But then the unexpected benefit is, that's a really kind of emotionally acute way to journal. You know, so I would remember, you know, I'd smell the lilacs the first day the lilacs came out in Chicago, and it was like the same day that I'd gotten some big check I'd been waiting for. All these other things about the day would come back. So it's kind of a fun way to journal.
Well, we got to leave it there. Jude Stewart, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marty. This is a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Revelations in Air is the title of her book, and it's subtitled A Guidebook to Smell. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Our guest has been, our engineer has been Diana Martinez, and Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out with singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright singing Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road.
Crossing the highway late last night, He should have looked left and he should have looked right. He didn't see the station wagon car. The skunk got squashed and there you are. You got your dead skunk.